the day's biggest stories, the people behind the headlines, the conversations you won't hear anywhere else. I'm Christy Strasser. You're listening to Odyssey's On Deadline. While most of us are enjoying the 9 o'clock sunsets, it wasn't that long ago we were in pitch black at 5 p.m. A congressional move aims to end that, but will it take? Here's KCBS in the Bay Area.
And this debate seems to resurface every few years. So from your perspective, why has it been so difficult for Congress to reach a consensus?
Well, it's because there are three different options and all have some pros and some cons. The current system has a lot of benefits, but we have the problem of having to change the clock that one lose an hour of sleep one day a year. The alternative, having daylight saving time year-round, has a lot of problems as well. It's one of the things that's what's being proposed in Congress. And the third alternative, having year-round standard time, like having winter time all summer, has also its problems. So I think that's one of the reasons why I could keep saying controversial.
Do you weigh in on a favorite?
Yes, I do. I think, having considered in detail all these options, the current system is better than the alternatives. The system of having year-round daylight saving time, which is what is happening, what they're talking about in Congress now, we tried that before. So they seem to have forgotten, but of course it's a long time ago. But in 1974, there was an energy crisis, and the U.S. put in year-round daylight saving time, which means having daylight saving time in the winter, because we did have it in the summer already. And everybody liked it until it actually happened. And once it happened, in the middle of the winter of 1973 to 74, it became very unpopular very quickly. People didn't like getting up in the dark, going to work in the dark, and they particularly didn't like sending their kids to school in the dark, walking on dark city streets or waiting for buses on dark country roads. And it became, in a very short time, very unpopular around the country. And the Congress had put in this year-round daylight saving time as a temporary measure because of an energy crisis, and they put it in for 2 years. Well, it was so unpopular that they actually repealed it after 1 year, and they didn't even let it go the second year when it would have just automatically terminated. So it was very unpopular when we tried it before, and it makes sunrises very late all over the country in places like San Francisco and New York, Chicago, Dallas, Denver. Sunrise would be 8:30 or so. In some places like Detroit, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Seattle, sunrise would be 9 a.m. And if the sun is rising at 9 a.m., almost everybody getting up in the dark, going to work in the dark. And nobody liked it. And so, as I said, it's been tried, and it was found to be very unpopular, and it was repealed quickly. So I think what might happen this time, there's a lot of these people that think they're going to like it and are supporting it right now. When it actually happens, they may not be so happy with it.
Yeah, well, I guess you're there to remind them. Remember when, in the 70s.
That's right.
California voters approved Proposition 7 in 2018, allowing the state to adopt permanent daylight saving time at the federal law changes. So it hasn't happened. Why can't the state simply adopt permanent daylight saving time on its own?
The current law, which was passed in 1966 and is still the current law, says that each state has two options. They could have year-round standard time, which means never going on daylight saving, or they could have the system that we have now, which is daylight saving time about 8 months a year. It does not give the option of having year-round daylight saving time in that law, and that's the current law. So that's why two states have chosen. Out of the 50, almost every state has chosen to take the current system, but two states have chosen to go on year-round standard time, and those are Hawaii and Arizona. And they both have particular reasons to do that. Hawaii is very in the south, close to the equator, where the sun doesn't change too much. Arizona is just so hot in the summer that they don't want any extra daylight. But the rest of the people like having daylight saving time in the summer. And in fact, that's why year-round standard time, which is one of the alternatives, has a lot of problems as well, because a lot of the daylight saving time, when it isn't causing very dark mornings, has a lot of benefits by having a nice, beautiful summer evenings, an extra hour every day. And it does in the spring, summer, and fall cut back on energy usage, traffic accidents, crime, and a lot of other things. So it has a lot of benefits, spring, summer, and fall. But in the winter, it has this big negative. And that's why I think the current system, with its flaws, is about the best we can do.
Right.
So now, I'd approve the current system. Just like one quick thing. I think the problem with the current system is a lot of people don't even know when daylight saving time is coming. They don't plan for it. When people travel to another time zone, like flying from Chicago to New York, they plan for it. They maybe don't go to bed that late the day before. They don't wake up early the next morning. So would have too many plans the next morning. So if people knew that daylight saving time was coming, and I would suggest having public service announcements the week before daylight saving time is coming, say, have daylight saving time, it's coming. You better maybe prepare a little. Don't stay up too late Saturday night. Don't make too many plans Sunday morning. A lot of people would be able to do it the same way that travelers do all the time when they go from London to Paris or Beijing to Tokyo, a lot of places where there's a one-hour time change. People do all the time and have no real problem.
I feel like we do that a lot on the radio. We always say, "Oh, spring forward and fall back," and we tell our listeners, but maybe not. So,
right,
just
right.
One quick question, though: if you had to predict what Congress is going to do, what do you think?
Well, who knows? They almost passed it this year on daylight saving. They almost passed it a few years ago, and then it didn't. So I've given up trying to guess what Congress is going to do. But I would hope that they do nothing, because, as I said, I think if they do, they may regret it afterwards.
If we were a betting type, we're not sure which way we could go on the possibility of daylight saving time disappearing. But what happens in a world where you can bet on virtually anything? Here's Rob Hart in Chicago.
Experts warn they can mislead investors by amplifying speculation, bias, and unnecessary financial risk. Mark Hulbert, investment columnist for the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, and MarketWatch.com. This is a very good conversation to have, because a week ago, around this time, we received that story from Politico came out that forced Graham Plattner, the Senate candidate in Maine, to suspend his campaign. And something very interesting happened right before that Politico story dropped, and that is someone bought a lot of futures on one of the prediction markets that Plattner was going to suspend his campaign and soon, which means someone knew something before that story was published. And Mark, that really does reveal the problem that exists in most prediction markets. You're betting against someone who knows something and you don't.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, the insider trading to which you refer is just one of many problems that prediction markets have. I should acknowledge that the stock market and every other market around the world always has been subject to insider trading abuses. So that is not unique to prediction market. But what is unique to prediction markets is an additional problem, which is that the people with the most money can really affect the price of the underlying contract that you're betting on. So the underlying justification for why everyone has thought that prediction markets were a good guide to what may happen is that if you have a very diverse group of investors, none of whom have more influence than others, then the crowdsourced opinion of all of those people collectively will be more insightful than any one of us individually could have. But when you have that condition not met, which is to say what happens in the prediction markets when you have so-called whales, these huge traders that can swamp the market and affect the price, then you're really not betting against a crowdsourced opinion. You're betting against somebody who has a lot of money. And we all know that that doesn't mean that they have any particular insight.
And you bring up a very important point, is that long before Kalshi and Polymarket, there was something called Predict-It. And if you were one of those election prediction nerds way back when, Predict-It was a pretty good resource for where you thought particular races were going. But then all of a sudden, people with a lot of money and a lot of time stepped up to the plate and they became whales on that particular service, and it began distorting the predictive and informational power that particular site had.
Absolutely. And it's the way I think of it is that popularity ended up being it was a curse, really, but because basically when it was not that popular and people were actually not swamping the market with huge whale-like trades, then you're quite right that these markets had perhaps more insight than any one of us individually. And early on, in fact, studies showed that they were more reliable than opinion polls, the Gallup or Harris or any of the other polls. But as soon as they became popular, people realized they could game the system, and people with a lot of money were especially able to game the system. And at that point, the prediction market stopped losing some of their insight.
And we have to point out, too, that equities markets are heavily regulated by the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And once again, if you are trading on insider information, that's a felony. And I love to point this out, Mark. The long financial legacy of the movie Trading Places is something called the Eddie Murphy Rule. And that is, if you happen to come across stolen government information, like the crop report in the movie, you can't trade on it. That's against the law. And those rules don't exist on prediction markets right now.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the legislative and political battles that will have to be settled in coming months, because there's now so much money that is being traded on these prediction markets that I think politicians won't be able to turn a blind eye to the problem. And, I don't see any theoretical reason for why prediction markets shouldn't be subject to the same regulations that, the stock and bond markets should as well.
If you were going to place a bet on what's causing the explosive diarrhea spreading across the U.S. this summer, this may be something you'd already considered. Here's WWJ in Detroit.
Why does it feel like nobody really gives us the inside scoop? Join us on The Powers That Be, the podcast where insiders from Puck break down who has influence, how they use it, and what it actually means for you. New episodes every weekday. Listen to The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
Federal and state health officials have a major new target in their search for the source of a massive stomach parasite outbreak. The Washington Post reports that investigators are now looking into whether Taco Bell played a role in the rapidly growing outbreak, which has now exploded to more than 3,300 cases here in Michigan. While no specific supplier or grower has been named, several locations in the Detroit area have already voluntarily pulled lettuce, cilantro, and guacamole from their menus. Michigan health officials say lettuce continues to be the common denominator that regularly comes up in patient interviews. Health officials are urging families to ditch bagged salad mixes for now and buy whole heads of lettuce instead, making sure to peel off the outer layers of that lettuce before washing. With more on cyclosporiasis, we're now joined live by Dr. Anu Malani, the Vice Chief of Staff and Infectious Disease Specialist at Trinity Health in Ann Arbor. Well, first things first, the health department says it's likely that lettuce or salad greens are the cause of the cyclosporiasis outbreak. So should we just stop eating lettuce completely for right now, Doc?
Well, I think this is, fluid and evolving, and so it is definitely dynamic. I think what you can do is, probably avoid the prepackaged salad kits, salad greens. I think that's where probably the most risk is. If you definitely feel like you want to get salad right now, I think the way to do that is to buy whole heads of lettuce and really to strip out those, those couple outer layers and rinse that thoroughly, under sort of clean water. So I think, you can definitely do it, but you should do it, keeping these prevention aspects in hand.
Hey, Dr. Malani, is it true that there's been some mixed messaging on this? Because people say to wash your produce to try to avoid the cyclosporiasis, but then we've heard that washing does not remove the parasite. So for people who might be confused, which one is it?
Yeah, washing will definitely help to remove it. Now, is it 100%? I don't know that anything is ever 100%. For example, cyclosporiasis and raspberries, there's been, previous outbreaks associated with raspberries. Those can be very difficult to clean if you just think about, the outer hairs of a raspberry and trying to, get in there and, the parasites can kind of, hide in there. I think, lettuce, whole heads of lettuce, you can definitely, strip the outer layers, and that's where the contamination is going to be. And again, it's important to recognize we don't actually have a definitive, source or producer. We don't know that yet. Hopefully we'll know that soon. But I think you can, try to rinse this under cold water, taking off those outer layers and trying to be, as safe as possible. Is it 100%? It may not be 100%, but I think that's going to lower risk significantly.
Dr. Malani, you mentioned raspberries. We've heard a lot about lettuce. Are there other vegetables that might be affected by cyclosporiasis as well?
Well, I think we don't know, right? We don't know yet. I think, you did a really nice job in articulating kind of what we do know in the first part of this. And I think based on the health department press release from yesterday, I mean, I think it is pointing towards lettuce and salad greens. I don't think we know that definitively, but in the past, there have been outbreaks associated with cilantro, you know, basil, snow peas. I think, again, the key is really to, you know, we should be doing this anyways on a routine basis, but, you know, washing the vegetables, washing the fruits. In some cases, we want to try to use scrub brushes to keep things clean. And if you find that, you know, there are parts of, a vegetable or fruit that look bad, well, then taking that off. So in general, you know, thinking about sort of prevention aspects till we know further, if you can cook it, try to cook it. Generally above, 158 Fahrenheit or 70 degrees Celsius, that'll kill cyclospora. If you can peel it, try to peel it. And then trying to, at this point, avoiding those sort of prepackaged salad greens and kits.
Dr. Milani, final question for me. There have been some viral stomach bugs that have also been going around at the same time that the cyclosporiasis has been going around. So can I tell the difference between something else and cyclosporiasis?
Yeah, I think there are some key differences. And, you know, the most common GI bug that we hear about is a virus called norovirus. And that's often, you have nausea, vomiting. You can have also lower GI symptoms. But that'll actually resolve. That'll resolve on its own in a couple of days. And that actually can definitely be spread amongst households. It can be spread from person to person. You know, that's what we often hear about on, cruise ships and, daycares. That's much different than cyclospora. Cyclospora is going to be not spread person to person. So you may not have everyone in the household having cyclospora. It may be based on, whether you ate at a particular place and maybe, unfortunately, had some contaminated, food, in this case, maybe produce. And then the other difference is the incubation period for this is a little bit longer. So it's often, can be up to, 2 weeks after the exposure, but it's usually about a week. And so your symptoms are beginning in about a week after exposure. And it's usually, most commonly, the symptoms are watery diarrhea. And people can definitely feel bloated, have abdominal pain. You can also have some upper tract symptoms. But, these typically are not going to go away. While it can be self-limited, in many patients, these won't go away after a couple of days, and it'll continue. And the other difference is, and the reason why it's important to know that you have cyclospora, is that it's very treatable. And so we have, antibiotics that are effective for this.
Digging into a salad may feel like a risk, but so could stepping outside this week as temperatures soared into the triple digits in many areas and Canadian smoke blanketed the skies in the Midwest and East Coast. Here's more from WCCO in Minneapolis.
So far, fires have burned more than 33,000 acres across the Superior National Forest. Forest Service spokesperson Christine Kolinsky says that wilderness rangers are sweeping the million-acre boundary waters to guide campers out of harm's way during an unprecedented 104-degree heat wave.
I've heard they've evacuated over 50, and all along, hundreds of people are self-evacuating. Our staff continues to help get people out, shuttling people from their exit points to their vehicles.
Governor Tim Walz this morning meets with state officials to vote on extending the peacetime emergency he declared at the start of the week in response to the wildfires raging in northern Minnesota. The governor and emergency executive council will be briefed on the fires ahead of their vote, which would extend the emergency for an additional 30 days past August 11th. The original emergency order authorized the National Guard to assist with firefighting and relief efforts.
The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has issued an unprecedented maroon-level air quality alert for the state's northeastern region as heavy smoke from the Boundary Waters wildfires drifts south. State meteorologist Matt Tarldson warns the hazardous air will continue moving toward the Twin Cities, where residents can expect to see and smell the smoke by late tonight.
The Twin Cities here will have enough distance to go where it'll disperse some, so it'll be at that red or unhealthy for everyone. But the maroon level is likely to remain in the Arrowhead for the next several days.
He says they will continue to monitor the weather to determine if the health alert needs to be extended. Taylor Rivera.
Evacuations have begun in parts of northeastern Minnesota along the Canadian border where wildfires continue to burn. Already, nearly 20 people were airlifted to safety from the area. And St. Louis County officials say others have been told to get ready to move out if conditions continue to worsen. St. Louis County Sheriff Gordon Ramsey says those in impacted areas need to be on alert today.
One of the concerns is that if the winds change and the smoke comes in, it could make evacuation a little more difficult. So please stay alert and stay tuned to us and the Forest Service for what's happening around here.
An air quality alert is also in effect in that region, a purple alert. MCA's Matt Taraldson says they're tracking that smoke that's coming from those fires with high temperatures worsening conditions.
Low-level winds have been such that a lot of that smoke has been going up into Canada, but the winds will turn from the northwest as a cool front moves its way through, and that will push smoke south of the border into the Arrowhead of Minnesota and eventually into parts of central Minnesota as well.
This stretch of 90-plus degree weather could get worse and close to breaking records, but not the all-time record, according to WCCO-TV Chief Meteorologist Chris Schaefer.
We did have 9 consecutive days in the summer of 2005. We did it again in the summer of 2006. And 14 years ago, we had 8 consecutive days with highs in the 90s. Right now, we're at 3. Today will be the 4th. And I think we could match that 8-day streak if things hold like they are.
He says there were 14 consecutive days with temperatures in the 90s back in 1936.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Berry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money, still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.